From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis and I discussed this week's State of the Union address and some of the foreign policy objectives President Obama outlined in Tuesday night's speech.
We must give diplomacy a chance to succeed.
He has slowly gotten us out of the Middle East, and that's his achievement.
And later, I'll talk with Iranian-American novelist Laleh Khedivi.
How does someone like a Kurd who has no flag and no president, how do they move about the world?
And Palestinian-American poet and physician Fadi Judah.
Why do we go on convinced that this is an unchangeable inevitability, this idea of the nation-state?
Migration and identity in literature. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Joshua Landis, let's talk about the State of the Union address this week. And of course, the heavy focus was on domestic issues, but there was quite a bit of time spent on foreign policy. A lot about Afghanistan, Syria, Iran. Iran really wins the day, right? I mean, there was a lot of talk about Iran.
Well, he just got an agreement on Iran, and that's you know, and what has he done? He is known, his foreign policy is about getting out of the Middle East. And he has slowly gotten us out of the Middle East. And that's his achievement in foreign policy.
Well, he's slowly drawn down the number of troops in the Middle East, but our attention is still heavily focused on the Middle East, right? There's never been that pivot to Asia. There's no room really, at least in this speech or anywhere else, for focus on the rest of the world.
That's
We're still
true.
Very
and
focused on the Middle
carries
East.
Carries three initiatives. Are Syria, and he's been in Geneva all week, Arab-Israeli conflict, which continues to go on, and the Iran initiative. You know, he claimed big successes, both Syria because of the chemical weapons deal that was made in September, and Syrian chemical weapons have been exported, but they've stalled recently because the talks in Geneva did not go well. Kerry came out and he demanded regime change and that Assad's got to go. And clearly Assad didn't like that, and he's putting the brakes on the chemical weapons, showing that he can punish him. Iran, he has an achievement.
Unprecedented inspections help the world verify every day that Iran is not building a bomb. And with our allies and partners, we're engaged in negotiations to see if we can peacefully achieve a goal we all share. Preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
There's a six-month agreement, and it makes Iran stop enriching uranium beyond 5%. The stockpile of 20% enriched uranium has to be diluted, and no new centrifuges. So this will keep Iran from enriching to weapons-grade uranium. It's got to be renegotiated in 6 months. And what does Iran get? $6 to $7 billion. Now, admittedly, almost $5 billion of that $6 to $7 billion is money, Iranian money, that we've had frozen in bank accounts ever since the Iranian revolution.
Well, the big lesson here, I think President Obama was trying to tell us, was that diplomacy is the best course of action. Diplomacy backed by force, right? And he even referenced the fact that the Syrians came to the table and made an agreement about chemical weapons because of the threat of force, that the Iranians have come to the table because of sanctions and sanctions being so tough on the country. But yet diplomacy is where we need to head.
If John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan could negotiate with the Soviet Union, then surely a strong and confident America can negotiate with less powerful adversaries today.
Is this really what Obama is to be known for, is to be, you know, he's a gifted and key diplomat?
Well, he's making a virtue out of his weakness, I think. And the fact that we've been withdrawing, he does not want us to get into wars, has made his critics call him weak. And he is trying to make a virtue out of this weakness. The fact that we have not used more force in Syria, the fact that we have not used force against Iran. Many people think we should bomb Iran. He's saying no. And I think the majority of the American people are behind him on this today, although they see him as weak. They don't want to spend the money.
But there are some other things that we can pick on here, right? I mean, he mentioned in his speech about putting limits on the use of drones, for example. And yet he's a president that's used drones dramatically around the world to fight this war on terror. He still hasn't closed down Guantanamo Bay, something that everybody expected him to do, something he ran on in 2008. Surveillance, the NSA, and limits on surveillance programs. I mean, these are things that, you know, he's struggled with over the years. So he's got these great achievements that he's talked about. Iran, as you mentioned, the bringing Syria to the table. But he's got all these other things that are really clouding his success.
The left wing of the Democratic Party are very upset with Obama. They feel very let down that on almost every issue he hasn't made a big stand, that he has been a go-along president. And that was the major criticism, I think, of his speech the other night, is he no dramatic moves. This was a checklist of his little accomplishments, of little things he might do, no inspiration for the left wing of the party.
Yeah, it's a tough year, though. It's an election year. I guess we'll have to see what happens. I'm actually surprisingly already looking forward to next year's State of the Union address to see what we might be able to achieve this year of action that he calls for.
And in this time
foreign policy and
otherwise, of belt tightening, what can you do? I mean, the fact that he has not gotten us into the war, he's gotten us out of the Middle East.
Not out, just drawn down.
That is so true. But out compared to what we've been seeing for the previous decade. And that's those are achievements in and of itself for belt tightening.
Well, Joshua Landis, as always, thank you for discussing your perspective with us on Worldviews.
So it's a pleasure being here.
If you have any questions for me or Joshua or a comment about this discussion, let us know in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. You can also send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU or individually at Suzette Grelot and at Joshua_Landis. Coming up, I'm joined by two authors who focus on issues of identity in the Middle East. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Today, I'm joined by a novelist and a poet who both write about identity issues in the Middle East. Lale Khedivi was born in Iran, but immigrated to the United States with her family as a toddler shortly after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. A decade ago, she started to research her Kurdish heritage and has written two novels tracing the migration experiences of three generations of Kurds. Fadi Judah works as an emergency room physician in Houston by day, but won the Yale Series of Younger Poets competition in 2007. His translations of Arabic poetry have earned him international recognition. Lale Khedivi and Fadi Judah, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Lale, I'm going to start with you. You're of Iranian background, Iranian-American. You're in the process, I guess, of writing a trilogy about Kurdish immigrants. What drew you to that subject?
Well, my father is Kurdish, so I grew up in a household full of stories about what it is to be a Kurd. And having recognized myself as an Iranian, I was wondering, what is this other layer that holds so much tension and beauty for my father and his siblings. So I did a little bit of investigation into the Kurds that wasn't folkloric and wasn't just stories my family was telling. And I was realizing that 40 million people without a country in constant flight is really interesting. And it is a statement to our modern world and our obsession with statehood that I wanted to explore. And I wanted to figure out how, in this time of hyper-identification, does someone like a Kurd who has no flag and no Olympic team and no president, how do they move about the world? There are many Kurdish immigrant communities in Germany and in London, and in, you can go to Karachi and find Kurds, you know, and in the United States, but they have no country from which they are from. And what does this do to their sense of self? And so the trilogy follows three generations of men. It follows a grandfather, a father, and a son. And the grandfather is a tribe member in the western part of Iran when Iran becomes a state for the first time rather than a collection of tribes. And what happens to him once he goes from being a tribe member to becoming a citizen and a member of the Shah's army. And then I follow his son, who flees the Kurdish region of Iran because he commits a crime, but also because he's obsessed with the United States and with cinema. So he wants to come to Los Angeles. And then I write about the grandson who is not identified with his Kurdish background at all, who considers himself completely American, even though none of his blood is. And he's 100% Kurdish and yet has no sense of what that might mean and deals with kind of the ghosts of his ancestry.
So as part of the process here is to demonstrate how immigration really does separate one eventually from your identity, your ethnic identity.
Does and doesn't. Yeah, I think that in many ways identity is a construct and you are constantly imbued from the moment you're born until the moment you die with the stories and the scent and the kind of atmosphere of everybody who came before you. If your parents speak, that's inevitable. And so migration, which I think of it more rather than immigration, that's a political idea. Migration, which is what people do, like birds or whales, is this result of tensions in where they were from. And so they have to flee the tensions. And what happens to the life of the heart and the life of the mind when the earth beneath you is different and how that changes your perception of who you are and who you can be?
Very interesting. So Fadi, related to that, I mean, you're a Palestinian American. I just want to pick up on something Laleh was saying about, you know, 40 million people without a country. I mean, you know, Palestinians experience a similar situation, not maybe as numerous, but, you know, they have their territories, but they don't really have, you know, a country in the same way as the Kurds do. And there's a significant diaspora of the Palestinian peoples. But tell us about your work. I mean, you're largely a poet and I think, interestingly, also a physician and kind of how these things come together and what you're writing about in terms of reflecting that particular identity and expressing thought about these issues.
Yeah, I you know, feel very touched by what Laleh said. The idea of the goal, perhaps, of not belonging anywhere in the world is perhaps an endeavor of literature, you know, because identity is always a construct. And I think if you look at the writings and the lives of many mystics in the world, whether they be Eastern, Western, whatever compass you want to subject them to, they've always sought the idea of belonging by not belonging anywhere in the world. So, you know, as a Palestinian and as a physician, or as a poet and as a physician, I think I have come to think of displacement or not belonging through the word body and the world body, where I realize that we are constantly migrating, to use Laleh's words, within the body that we're born with or given, so to speak. As we age in life, we are displaced and migrate within that body. And that body also itself has its own self, sometimes separate from us, and wants something else for itself, so to speak. And how do we deal with it? And subjugating it to science, to methodology, doesn't always work. And as a Palestinian, and a poet and bilingual and what have you, it's also those levels of displacements come at a larger scale and ask us different questions than the daily difficulties of being displaced within your own body as your knees give out or your hair falls out or your, you know, skin wrinkles.
I'm speaking with Palestinian-American physician and poet Fadi Judah and Iranian-American novelist Laleh Khedivi. We'll talk more right after this break. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. My guests are novelist Laleh Khedivi and physician and poet Fadi Judah. Just before the break, Judah compared the physical displacement of a body breaking down to the displacement he feels as a Palestinian without a recognized state. You know, as I'm hearing the both of you talk about displacement and movement and, you know, separation from your home, if you will, or your original culture or your way of life, a lot of people may not identify with that if they aren't necessarily migrants or people that have moved from one place to another, like animals, as you were saying. But Fadi, what you're referring to is that we actually do experience that. This is a very universal human thing that we experience regardless of your background and regardless of your movement, that within your own existence, displacement and movement or, you know, seeking of belonging is something inherent in what you know, we all experience in life.
Well, I think it goes back again to what Lali said in that, you know, we live in an age that is obsessed by the nation state construct, and that is only a construct. And it is part of literature's endeavor to ask the population en masse, you know, why do we go on fully convinced that this is an unchangeable inevitability, this idea of the nation state construct? And so, yes, we are displaced not only in the body but also on the psychological level. You know, you have your heartbreak or a loss on a small level, or, you know, and these things affect you and you're constantly walking around displaced. But I think we've come, I think, within an American frame to almost use these as pretexts to efface wider, harder conversations about other forms of displacement. And somehow that we tend to think of them as Americans, as those problems that affect other kinds of people and never us, you know. And it's a deeper problem. And I would like to say Mahmoud Darwish has a beautiful poem called "The Kurd Has Only the Wind."
Mm-hmm. I know that poem.
And it's for a Syrian Kurd poet. Yeah.
That's the one thing they share together, no matter where they are.
Some people may disagree with the title because everybody, you know, the Palestinians want a state and then many Kurds want a state. But here come two poets and come in and say, you know, at least on the page, there is something about belonging to a higher space, if you will, or dimension.
That we can still belong to one another or belong to a particular idea, regardless of where you are and
or to nature in that sense,
or to
you
nature,
know,
right.
Like the wind, the notion. The Kurds and the wind are very often referred together. But there is something that you were saying in terms of, well, first, I think it's literature's job to take these external things such as migration and displacement and to internalize them in a way that any human being on the planet, even the one who has lived in the same house their whole life, can understand. That is the work of art in many ways. But something that I find really interesting is, as a writer who's working on a trilogy, some of which takes place in the future, to kind of open people's eyes to the idea that, A, the nation state is no more than 200 years old at its best. And before that, everything was a collection of tribes that made empires. And after this, we are approaching a post-national world. The internet and the availability of access to multiple private niche-oriented identities that are online are going to have us affiliated to one another in ways that were previously impossible. And our national identities might just be relegated to football teams or soccer teams. You know, that will be as much as we can tie ourselves to a place. Because even now, if you think about the American identity, Texans don't think they have anything in common with Californians. There is not a cohesion in the way that one might imagine in an Eisenhower era or something like that. And so there's this movement away from the national self into this not necessarily global self, but it's going to be a self that's, to my mind, a mix of commerce and class and race and political ideas that you can tie yourself to and bind with in a way that you might have when you said the Pledge of Allegiance as a 5-year-old in class or were forced to, that might not be necessary of us anymore.
Well, there certainly are nested identities that we each have, right, that some of which are salient at sometimes rather than others. I mean, my Oklahoman identity is perhaps salient when I'm speaking with a Texan, but my, you know, U.S. identity or American identity, that might be salient when I'm speaking to somebody from overseas. Mm-hmm. But I want to get back to this kind of, you know, quickly, this notion of the job of literature. You said that it's the job of literature to express these ideas ideas and to share these kinds of feelings and emotions, if you will. But, you know, we do this, of course, by translating literature from one language to another. And I imagine there might be some things that are difficult to translate. But I'm wondering if the electronic, I mean, you mentioned how easy it is with the internet today to share these things, that with, you know, today's technological capability, that we actually are able to share these things in a much more efficient and effective way, and that people that, you know, may not have had access to a particular work of literature or poem or what have you, that is something that is becoming much more ubiquitous today, and that has had a, I mean, can you tell that that's had an impact on the work that you do in terms of who can access it, who reads it, your audience, if you will? I mean, what do you think about that concept?
I'm a Luddite, so I chose to become a writer and accepted the sort of the work of it insofar as I knew it would tie me to age-old tradition of storytelling. And as a novelist, you can't, unless you're really, really good, fit it into 160 characters. So you have to actually get a person to sit down for a sustained amount of time and enter a world.
Right, but they have access to digital books now, right? You can you can download something on Kindle, you know, around the world, for example.
I mean, but the writing still has to
seduce. The writing is still the same. Exactly.
You know, still has to get the person.
So you've got that old traditional method that's now being...
The medium is irrelevant on some... I mean, eventually they will just stream it directly into our brains. And so then we won't have to sit at all and we can just hear the sort of echoes of it.
But they do have audiobooks, I guess.
Which I love, actually. Yeah. I'm like, someone is going to tell me a story for 4 days. I think that the medium is constantly changing. And if I think about that too much, it'll be frustrating because it's too much information and I'd rather not. But I've heard studies that people are reading more because of technology, that their time with words in front of their face is more than it was 25 years ago.
Question is what they're reading and what
quality. I don't
want
to ask that question. Don't ask that question. Don't ask that question.
No, that is the question. I mean, without a doubt, I think that we're reading more because there's so much more available for us to read. But the question is the quality of that. And are we reading the right things? You know, what are we having access to?
And I think on that note, I think it becomes also part of literature's endeavor to question the problematic of information as surveillance. And I think the excess of writing and reading, while a good thing always, it's always better to be literate than less literate. But I also think it becomes a pretext for surveillance. And how does literature write or rewrite itself in this day and age where it counters that also?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting topic, and perhaps we'll hold that for another show. Well, Lale and Fadi, thank you so much for being with us today. Very interesting conversation about the importance of this topic. Thank you
for having us.
You've been listening to my conversation with Palestinian-American physician and poet Fadi Judah and Iranian-American novelist Lale Khedivi. We have links to some of their work on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Hillary Gibson conducted the research for this interview, Nick Aguilera prepared this week's digital content, and Brian Hardzinski produces the show. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.